Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Christina Spouty, and I am serving as worship associate this morning. I am joined in welcoming you by the Venerable Shi Ying Fa, Abbot of Cloudwater Zendo, the Zen Center of Cleveland, who is our guest today, as our minister, Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zimmer, is at General Assembly.
It is the lack of love for ourselves that inhibits our compassion toward others. If we make friends with ourselves, then there is no obstacle in opening our hearts and minds to others.
So I would now like to introduce our guest this morning, Venerable Shi Ying Fa, who would like to lead us in a guided meditation.
Please sit comfortably and yet upright. And you may place your hands in your lap or hold them in whatever position seems appropriate. You may lower your gaze or completely close the eyes is also fine. The thing to remember is that although we may be able to go for an extended period without either food or water, we cannot go very long without breath. Our breath is our life. So we are going to pay attention to that breath, which is our life, beginning with simply following your breath with your mind. Put your attention on the breath as it comes in and goes out. And now, having calmed the mind through following the breath, bring your attention up underneath the nose to the point right between the nostrils. Keep your attention there, as though you were in a toll booth, but no one was stopping to pay the toll. And simply observe as the breath goes in past the nostrils and out past the nostrils. Now that we have focused our attention in this manner, let us drop our attention straight down to about an inch or so below the navel, a great spiritual center of many traditions, and simply focus on that spot as you continue to concentrate on your breath, eventually allowing the breath and you to merge into one being, yourself and your life itself. And now, having become one with our life itself, let us open our hearts and minds to each other so that we may share this interdependent realization with everyone here.
Let us be at peace with our bodies and our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become holy ourselves. Let us be aware of the source of being, common to us all and to all living things. Evoking the presence of the great compassion, let us fill our hearts with our own compassion toward ourselves and toward all living beings. Let us pray that we ourselves cease to be the cause of suffering to each other. With humility, with awareness of the existence of life, and of the sufferings that are going on around us, let us practice the establishment of peace in our hearts and on earth. Amen.
In 1954, shortly before his death, great Zen master Qihong said the following: "Wake up to what you do and think each day. Keep account of every right and wrong. When you have made peace with yourself, north, south, east, and west are all the same. If someone has yet to cross the ford, never run away to save yourself. True nature is still and void. Cause and effect are never off even a hair. Whatever you do, you're doing to yourself, No one can suffer in your place. Followers of illusion, reflections of moon on water, here is where to build your place of truth. Everywhere tie threads that lead to Buddha. Seize this moment to save yourself and others. Great Master Bai Zhang, the author of the first Zen monastic code, wrote, "The sutra says, to behold the Buddha nature, you must wait for the right moment and the right conditions. When the time comes, you are awakened as if from a dream. You realize what you have found is your own and does not come from anywhere outside. An ancient ancestor said, after enlightenment, you are still the same as you were before. There is no mind and there is no truth. You are simply free from unreality and delusion. The ordinary person's mind is the same as the sage's, because original mind is perfect and complete in itself. When you have arrived at this recognition, please hold on to it." Oh, good morning, everyone. It is. I'm very grateful to be here today. Happy to see old SI friends and hopefully some new ones, which is always great. Many thanks to you and many thanks to Christina and to Christy Anderson, who were so very helpful in getting this all put together. So I'm here to talk about the Dharma of dealing with it. So what exactly is dealing with it? Well, dealing with it means that most things we encounter require some sort of action on our part. These things can be external, internal, or both. Externals, answering the door because the doorbell's ringing. Internals, doubts, fears, anxieties, or maybe the combination of the two. The doorbell's ringing, I hope it's not someone trying to sell me something. The way we deal with things depends on what's being dealt with and our own state of mind. And so we have these senses through which we process information. And our eyes can see ugliness or beauty. Our ears can hear dissonance or harmony. Our noses can smell something noxious or something pleasing. Our tongue can taste something that's bitter or acidic or mouth-watering and delicious. Our skin can feel pain or comfort. And our minds can experience unsettling thoughts or peaceful ones. Now, notice that for every non-pleasurable sensation, there is its opposite, a pleasing one. And this is a very simple and elegant confirmation of the Buddha's first noble truth, which is the fact that suffering is woven into the fabric of our existence. You'd think that we'd all be reconciled to this, but the truth is, we don't like suffering, which is reasonable. It hurts. It's disruptive. It makes us crazy. And it can lead to even more suffering. This is obvious. Nobody likes to suffer or to feel pain or disappointment or anger or fear. So why do many of us tend to pay more attention to our suffering than to our lack of suffering? Well, the truth is that for many of us, the suffering tends to stick out more. And when we suffer, we crave its opposite. Have you ever noticed this isn't the case when we're happy? In happy times, you don't say, "I wish happiness would go away." So since the state of non-suffering is our preferred state, dealing with things tends to be about the negative aspects of life. How can I end my suffering? Trouble is, we've come up with lots of different ways not to deal with something that's bothering us. One way is we do nothing or very little. We deny it. "This isn't real. I'm not going to give it the time of day." And the classic, "This isn't happening." "Yes, it is." We rationalize. We make up excuses to avoid looking at the truth of whatever the situation happens to be. We engage in all kinds of faulty reasoning that just excuses us from having to confront the situation. Sometimes we call it fate. "This is my lot. There's nothing I can do." We can drown ourselves in guilt. "It's all my fault and I probably deserve what I got." Or we can blame others. We do that a lot. The do-nothing approach may offer some temporary relief, but it doesn't really deal with what's going on. Another way we refuse to deal is to escape, getting out of harm's way, leaving the room, getting out of the office, just to get away from whatever is bothering us at the time. We can repress the difficulty or our reaction to it, but it inevitably returns. The Buddha said, "Not in the sky, not in the middle of the ocean, not even in the cave of a mountain should one seek refuge. None of these is a safe refuge, nor is it the supreme refuge. For even after arriving at a refuge, one is not emancipated from all suffering." We also try to compensate. One tactic is we selfishly embrace whatever is negative. This is my suffering, nobody else's. We take ownership. We wear it like a badge of honor and hope we get martyr status. We might also unselfishly embrace what is negative. We think that immersion in pain and agony might break us free. Liberation through self-flagellation. Conversely, we may cause others to suffer. Misery loves company, based in fear, based in anger. We say it's only fair. Not really. We try to compensate with an equal measure of pleasure, thinking that the scales will somehow balance. Or we may compensate with inordinate amounts of pleasure just to drown out the pain. What this leads to is everything from overeating to drug abuse. But of course, there are many ways that are reasonable that we do use to try to deal with things. We may seek help, going outside of our suffering self for assistance. It's very popular to try to find a way out of difficulties through books, DVDs, internet forums, Dr. Phil, whatever you have. Another approach we have is to confide in friends, relatives, social media contacts, relatives and whoever, because we know they'll lend a sympathetic ear. We can also turn to people who have experienced the same kinds of suffering that we have and may have some handy advice. And again, all these are very reasonable alternatives. We may turn to religion and spirituality as a way to bring peace, since these traditions have been helping suffering people for ages. Seeking help from counselors and psychiatrists is very popular and many times very effective. But the question that we have to ask ourselves is this: are we really being open to all of these positive methods, or are we just bringing our attitude of non-dealing to them? For example, is religion just a way to forget? Are psychiatry and counseling substitutes for healing and growth? Are we working with our clerics and our healthcare professionals, or are we just trying to let them do all the work? Are relatives and friends the company with whom we share our misery, which maybe isn't fair to them? From the Buddhist standpoint, the best way to deal is to attain the understanding that leads to transformation and eventually to transcendence. I'll make this point again. Attain the understanding that leads to transformation and eventually to transcendence. This means you become a keen observer of suffering while not giving it your own energy. Sometimes we get so involved in our suffering that the suffering we experience deepens rather than diminishing. Instead of giving our suffering more power, we need to turn that suffering into a teacher and into an ally. This approach replaces the dualistic battleground of me and my suffering, knocking heads. It replaces it with a reality in which the individual and the individual suffering are one and the same. When we're one with our suffering, we see it way more clearly than we do when we're at odds with it. And by doing so, we can figure out the most effective way to deal with it. If we see the roots of our suffering, the roots, it means we're facing our difficulties with an open mind, open eyes, and an open heart. And this turns any kind of suffering, into an opportunity for awakening, so good comes out of it. One of the most revered symbols in Buddhism is the lotus flower. The lotus flower has an intimate connection through its root with the slimy, dirty mud at the bottom of the pond. The two are inseparable. Without the root, there is no lotus. Without the lotus, there is no root. In our tradition, the shining example, of course, of someone who has endured all kinds of suffering and truly awakened is, of course, the Buddha, whose birth name was Siddhartha. And if we can look at Siddhartha's life pre-Buddhahood, we can get some insights into dealing with it. Young Siddhartha was always shielded from the negative aspects of life by his father, who was a wealthy and powerful member of the military caste. This meant that Siddhartha was a victim of the suffering of ignorance. He never really had the opportunity to develop a well-rounded view of the world. This ignorance led to the suffering of boredom. It was the same old thing day after day. Eat the best food, drink the best wine, make love to the most beautiful women, bask in everyone's adulation. Sounds great, right? Not so. It led to, over time, kind of a dull resignation in Siddhartha. His mind became restless. The restlessness produced uncertainty. The uncertainty nagged at his mind until he became absolutely angst-ridden. Even the birth of his first son couldn't help. He named the boy Rahula. In the ancient language, Rahula means fetter. Just another chain dragging me down. It's like naming your first child Millstone. Same thing. But when Siddhartha finally figured out that people can get sick, they can age, and they can eventually die, then he got really confused. Particularly when he cast his eyes on a very peaceful spiritual seeker who seemed to be above all of the suffering. I've got everything and I'm miserable, and there's this old dude down there who's happy as a clam. I don't get it. His confusion led to a state of terrible doubt, even about his own existence. Then he experienced fear, which was so unlike anything he had experienced in 29 years of life, that he became alienated, anxious, moody, and depressed, until he finally decided, I've had enough, I have to find peace. His father used to try throwing him large parties when he got this way, but it only made things worse. Siddhartha had already tried rationalization, repression, escapism, and so on. None of them worked, so he took off. He left home. He ended up studying with two meditation masters for a couple of years, but even after mastering meditative techniques, he found his basic issues were still there. So then he switched to the immersion in suffering tactic by becoming an ascetic. He figured that mortifying his body would be the key to unlocking his heart and mind. But 5 years after that, emaciated and exhausted by all this strenuous asceticism, he realized that despite what he had seen through the ascetic practice, he was still no closer to his answer. So he quit the ascetic path altogether. So when you look at a person like Siddhartha, he had gone from luxury to poverty. He had gone from joy to depression and back again. And through this, he realized that the middle ground between these extremes was the way that he had to go. So what arose from that was a great sense of determination forged in the fire of now 35 years of suffering. He saw that his suffering was his great teacher, that it set the stage for the journey through his mind, whose end product was an awakened one, a Buddha. So what can we learn from Siddhartha's struggle? Well, one thing we learn is that what doesn't kill us can make us stronger if we deal with it directly. See, everybody's fond of Friedrich Nietzsche, "That which does not kill us makes us stronger." But there's a quote from Nietzsche that I like better. "To live is to suffer. To survive is to find some meaning in the suffering." Siddhartha survived his suffering by dealing with it, which set the stage for his great awakening. So when the Buddha, now an awakened one, first taught his Four Noble Truths, the basis of Buddhism itself, he was talking about the Dharma of dealing with it. Noble Truth number one, recognize that you suffer and have compassion for yourself as a suffering being. This negates denial and introduces loving kindness into the equation. You heard Thich Nhat Hanh earlier. Thich Nhat Hanh also said that compassion is the intention and capacity to relieve and transform suffering and to lighten sorrows. The Buddha's noble truth number 2, look directly and deeply at the cause of your suffering, which is none other than desire, grasping, craving, wanting. This starts the active process of dealing with it and negates avoidance, repression, and blame. Noble truth number 3, be hopeful. Recognize that suffering isn't permanent, even though it might feel like that. This prevents self-martyrdom and promotes deep reflection about what suffering really is. Noble truth number 4, work the cure. In the Buddhist tradition, our cure is the Noble Eightfold Path, where we constantly work to govern our actions, our speech, and our thought so that they don't cause any harm to anyone or anything. Remember, dealing with it is a process, not a one-shot cure. The process may be uneven, probably will be, but at least you're on a path. The path points in the direction of that transformation and transcendence I talked about. Without a path to go through, it's very difficult to transform suffering. In Buddhist terms, transformation starts with recognizing that what we call the three poisons, craving, anger, delusion, are literally eating us up. Ignorance creates craving since we don't fully realize our interdependent nature. Lacking that, we think that we need more of everything, so we thirst more. Our frustration at not getting what we want leads to disappointment, frustration, anger, hatred. Hatred amplifies ignorance, creates more craving, leads to more anger, and so it just spirals out of control. It's like addiction. Once we realize that these poisons are the main cause of our difficulties, we can then take steps to redirect that energy. We can transform craving into non-attachment, anger into loving kindness, and eventually delusion into wisdom. This is how we can turn every episode of suffering into an opportunity to awaken. It's the mud feeding the lotus. Every so-called negative becomes that nutrient-rich food that produces the lotus that we are. This helps us to see that every episode of misfortune is at the end of a cycle of cause, condition, and effect, not the beginning. Spiritual practice compels us to look directly at what's causing our difficulties, but we have to be disciplined about it. In Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about avoiding what's known as the three defects of a pot. If a pot is turned over so it's lying on its side, nothing can remain in the pot. If you don't listen, the teachings will not be heard. If a pot is cracked, the contents leak out. If you forget the teachings, they'll be lost. If the pot is poisoned, the contents are ruined. If you are attached to preconceived notions, the teachings may become distorted. But it's the pot that sits on its base, which is the one that contained the teachings and be that crucible we need to transform delusion into awakening. So by governing our actions, our speech, our thoughts, we're much better equipped to deal with whatever comes our way. We understand that all suffering is impermanent, even though it might not feel that way. We let compassion and wisdom manifest all the time. We develop the mind of equanimity, which can neither overreact nor underreact to whatever situation we encounter. We learn how to regard life as that interdependent whole, instead of seeing it as an endless sequence of discrete beings and events all just banging into one another. If we can allow what we call suffering to just blend into our personal landscape, we'll find dealing with it is a lot easier. We can be unattached to our suffering and yet aware enough to do something about it. In one of our Buddhist services, we refer to a legendary bodhisattva, an enlightening being who visits all the hell realms and brings relief to all the beings who are suffering in those realms. The way this quest is described is transforming the rain of confusion and replacing it with the light of spring. Once we've been able to transform that blinding rainstorm of confusion so that our own light of spring is shining, we can finally get to a place that's beyond all difficulty. We call this transcendence, and transcendence is the result of successfully dealing with it. A mantra we routinely chant at our temple in Sanskrit, Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. In English, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, enlightenment is here. So whatever difficulties we encounter are here, but our essential enlightenment is right here too. And this gives us strength, it gives us courage, it gives us discipline when it comes to dealing with it. So to wrap up, I'd like to outline just a short 5-step approach to dealing with it, which may prove helpful. Number 1, identify a form of suffering that you may be experiencing right now. Many to choose from, I'm sure. Just pick one. Number 2, look deeply into your heart and use whatever religious, spiritual, intellectual, whatever means you have at your disposal to see exactly where that suffering is really coming from. Be very honest about it. Number 3, name a positive quality that you would like to transform that particular suffering into. It's all energy. Number 4, formulate a strategy, a way, a practice, whatever you want to call it, that will transform your suffering into that positive quality. And number 5, work the cure. Work the cure. Don't let it sit there. Work it. And don't forget, you have to be understanding and patient with yourself. Extending compassion to oneself is no crime. It's not selfish. It is necessary. So you should do that. And so finally, to encourage ourselves as we attempt to transform our suffering and for the benefit of all living beings who are suffering alongside us, let us in our minds and hearts extend the following wishes. May all beings have true happiness. May all beings be freed from suffering and its causes. May all beings be one with the highest perfect joy. And may all beings dwell in equanimity, freed from discrimination and attachment. May all living beings walk the path of liberation together.
Today we are having our monthly special collection, and Kent Social Services is the recipient. They are in the process of upgrading their kitchen to meet the standards for a licensed commercial kitchen. More information about this project is in the thread. In the words of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, give what you have to somebody. It may be better than you think. Please consider giving as you are able. The offering will now be gratefully received. Special thanks to Shirley and Jonathan Kiernan and to Brad Bolton and Stephanie Summers for all of the musical pieces that they've added to the service today. Go in peace, speak the truth, give thanks each day. Respect the earth and her creatures, for they are alive like you. Care for your body, it is a wondrous gift. Live simply, be of service. Be guided by your faith and not your fear. Go lightly on your path, walk in a sacred manner. Amen.